So if you're lucky enough to be born in a rich country, your risk of death in that first year of life is about 0.5%. And current 10-year-olds have this incredible title. They've got a less than 1 in 10,000 chance of not making their 11th birthday. So I'm 40 this year, and that means my risk of death is about 1 in 1,000. By the time I'm 65, it'll be about 1%. By the time I'm 80, it's about 5%, so that's 1 in 20 per year. And if we're lucky enough to live into our 90s, but unlucky enough that none of the science we're going to talk about today has come to pass, you're going to have a risk of death of about 1 in 6. But what I've come to believe is that actually biology has many of the same questions. They're not like fundamental particles or, you know, the depths of deep space. But the fact is that our bodies are made up of somewhere between 30 and 40 trillion cells. And this is the science of complexity. The questions there are just as deep and just as fascinating, but they also have a huge potential to, you know, make people healthier. And if we can do gene therapies for longevity, which are a potential thing, you know, we've discovered a gene in an Amish population in the US that makes people live 10 years longer. We have loads of genes in animals that provide, you know, comparably exciting changes in lifespan. Would I bet against there being a longevity gene therapy in the next 10 or 20 years? I probably wouldn't, because the technology is advancing so fast.
To paraphrase the great Charles Darwin, species endure not by brute strength or vast intelligence, but by their capacity to adapt to shifting circumstances. As Mike Milken said on this podcast, the greatest achievement of humankind in the 20th century was the doubling of life expectancy. So if living longer seems a powerful goal, my caveat would be only if it goes hand in hand with being healthy whilst being older and in not running out of money. So, to bring his petri dish, scalpel, and stethoscope to this subject, we're delighted to welcome today Dr. Andrew Steele, lecturer, author, and speaker and expert on the topic of aging. As we all think about the health and financial implications of what may lie ahead. So, Andrew, over from Berlin today, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we had the pleasure of listening to you on this topic at the Money Maze Allocators Summit in October, ahead of the panel called Golden Dawn in Healthcare, where you created a palpable sense of amazement, curiosity, and hope.
Oh, thank you.
And I'd like to dissect this conversation into four parts: examination, diagnosis, treatment, and side effects. But before that, as if you were my patient, may we have some of your own family history first of all, please? Was your family steeped in science?
Not at all. My mum left school at 14, back when that was possible, and did a couple of O-levels at night school. My dad was a purchasing manager, and then actually he got sick of that job and grew plants for a living. So they both worked on a nursery until they retired a few years ago. So there is, I was given a lot of freedom as a child. They bought me a lot of books. My mum tells me that from the age of 7, I wanted to be an astrophysicist, and I've slowly moved further away from that goal, actually, as I've progressed through my scientific career. But ultimately, I was just amazed by the universe around me and wanted to, you know, understand more about it, and later on sort of make a difference with that understanding. And that's what ended up drawing me to longevity science.
Well, I know you will explain that you were a physicist who jumped across to become a biologist, and I think you have a PhD in physics from Oxford, but yes. Let's just talk about that academic route you took and the pivot.
So it was quite late in the day, actually, that I got interested in biology. I've, as I said, since I was 7 years old, wanted to be basically Stephen Hawking. I thought that was the sort of pinnacle of human understanding, to cover the whole of the universe by, you know, digging into some of its incredible depths. But by the time I got to university, I was much more keen, although I was studying physics, it's always been my passion throughout school. I wanted to do something a bit more practical. My PhD wasn't in astrophysics, it was in magnetism. But still quite a long way from application. These are little magnets that could have been in the quantum computers of the future or something like that, but they only worked a few degrees above absolute zero. You know, we went to giant particle accelerators and pummeled them with things called muons to try and understand what was going on inside them. And toward the end of my PhD, I was thinking, you know, this is still some way from helping people. And I was thinking, you know, what can I do with my life to maximize my benefit to the world? I had perhaps this slightly naive, you know, wide-eyed PhD student view of these things. I almost became a climate physicist, which would have been a much more logical use of my skills. In fact, my girlfriend at the time was a climate physicist doing a PhD. But I ended up reading a bit about aging biology. And I thought, this is remarkable, because I essentially changed career because of a graph, is the story I often tell. So this is a graph of, it's a very straightforward graph. I've got a copy of it on my laptop here to show you. It's a graph of how old you are along the bottom, so your age in years, and your risk of death in any one of those years at the side. And I think all of us know that older people are more likely to die, but just how much really shocked me. So the graph looks something like this. And you can see it's sort of wall of red coming at us as we move later into our lives. Let's try and put some numbers on that to make a bit more sense of it. So if you're lucky enough to be born in a rich country, your risk of death in that first year of life is about 0.5%. But After that, you sort of run that gauntlet. That risk actually goes down and down and down. And current 10-year-olds have this incredible title. They are the safest humans in the history of our species. They've got a less than 1 in 10,000 chance of not making their 11th birthday, which is just remarkable. But unfortunately, as you can see from this graph, it's all downhill or rather uphill from there. So I'm 40 this year, and that means my risk of death is about 1 in 1,000. And I quite like those odds. It's worth thinking about what that would mean. If that were to continue for the rest of my life, I'd live into my 1,040s on average. But unfortunately, of course, that isn't what happens. Humans have a risk of death that doubles about every 8 years. And that means if that carries on doubling and doubling and doubling and doubling, by the time I'm 65, it'll be about 1%. By the time I'm 80, it's about 5%. So that's 1 in 20 per year. And if we're lucky enough to live into our 90s, but unlucky enough that none of the science we're going to talk about today has come to pass, you're going to have a risk of death of about 1 in 6. And that's life and death at the roll of a dice. And there are two ways to look at this. You can either look at it as a human and think there's this terrifying, you know, exponential wall of mortality coming at me, or you can look at it as a physicist trying to, you know, think of a way to have an impact on the world. And you think, if we could understand this exponentially increasing risk of death, this ticking clock that's going on inside all of our biology, and potentially if we could do something about that ticking clock, we can make a really, really big difference. And so to sort of unpack that slightly further, the reason that our risk of death rises in this way is because the risk of diseases also rises in this way. So if you look at something like, this is the same graph essentially, but it's your risk of disease per year rather than your risk of dying up the side of the graph there. And so cancer, heart disease, stroke, dementia, these things all follow basically the same exponential-ish curve of massively increasing risk late in life. And so although, you know, we all know people in their 30s who have tragically got cancer very early, but most people who get cancer are diagnosed in their 60s, their 70s, their 80s. And then obviously that disease can go on to take their life. So that could be quite a depressing thought. But this was also around the time I finished my PhD around 2011. This was a time when we had various interventions that we could use to slow down the aging process in the lab. We had some drugs, we had some gene edits, we had dietary changes that we could make to animals, and we can talk a bit about those. But these things seem to actually slow down the aging process. They reduced that exponential increase in risk of death. They also reduced the risk of disease, the risk of frailty toward the end of life. And so I thought, this seems like a really big deal. This could potentially hit the root cause of many of the biggest killers in the modern world. And also the frailty, the wrinkles, the gray hair, you know, all the things that come along with it. But I also thought, I haven't studied biology since I was 16. Maybe I need to, you know, go back to school and try and find out if any of this is actually possible. Maybe I'm just a naive physicist blundering into a new field. And I ended up therefore going and working as a biologist for 5 years.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the World Gold Council. They champion the role gold plays as a strategic asset through expert research, commentary, and insights. And it's not just your portfolio that may benefit from gold. Learn how gold mining is supporting female economic empowerment and small businesses via their new documentary series called Gold, The Journey Continues. Tap the link in the show notes to start watching. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. Well, as somebody who is seriously non-scientific, and I would hate to share with the audience my academic or lack of academic success in the scientific disciplines, what is it that attracts somebody to biology rather than physics?
It's a really interesting question. I've actually come to the conclusion there are a lot of, you know, it's kind of weird actually how fascinated people are by astrophysics, and particle physics is even stranger. Like, you know, the Higgs boson back in 2012 when that was discovered, there was this huge media hubbub. And frankly, no one really understands what the Higgs boson is. Even, you know, even physicists don't necessarily understand the Higgs mechanism and the underlying science behind that. And yet somehow there's this deep fascination about the sort of fundamental mechanisms of the universe. But what I've come to believe is that actually biology has many of the same questions. They're not like fundamental particles or, you know, the depths of deep space. But the fact is that our bodies are made up of somewhere between 30 and 40 trillion cells. Those cells are all interacting with each other. There are hundreds of thousands of different proteins buzzing around inside our cells, you know, all day, every day. And this is the science of complexity. It's not the science of boiling things down to their absolute most fundamental particles and understanding how the universe works from a handful of building blocks. It's saying if we get all those building blocks together, we get this sort of symphony of incredible beauty and complexity that is life. And that also opens up the possibility of intervening in life in various ways. And of course, medicine has already been very successful in keeping us healthier, keeping us living longer, and so on. And I think that by understanding some of this sort of complexity science, which we are now newly able to do with advances in computing, advances in, you know, the ways that we can do biology research in the lab, the questions there are just as deep and just as fascinating, but they also have a huge potential to, you know, make people healthier.
Great. So as I said, examination, diagnosis, treatments, and side effects. Examination. Andrew, this is a really simple question, but I suspect the answer might be more complex. What is aging?
That is a deceptively simple question. Yeah. The first answer I often give is the statistical one that we've just talked about. So, I think that's actually a really good way to get a handle on this. So humans have a risk of death, as I said, that doubles every 8 years. And this is called our mortality rate doubling time. And every animal in the animal kingdom has a mortality rate doubling time. So if you look at a mouse, for example, mice live maybe 2 or 3 years in the lab. They have a mortality rate doubling time of months. So their risk of death is climbing much, much faster than ours. If you look at something like a dog, it might have a mortality rate doubling time. Again, you know, more months, but still only measured in months. Dogs live maybe 7 to 15 years, depending on the size of the dog. You know, big dogs typically live less long than smaller dogs do. But then if we look out more widely in the animal kingdom, there are some animals that have a very long mortality rate doubling time. Something like a bowhead whale, for example, can live to 200 years. And they're mammals. You know, they're obviously much bigger than us. They live in the ocean. They're not very similar biologically, but they're in the same sort of broad family. But the thing that I think is most fascinating is there are animals and other organisms that do not age by this statistical definition. So if you look at something like a Galapagos tortoise, these are animals that, you know, famously tortoises live a long time. They live perhaps 150, 200 years, depending on the species. But what interests me isn't so much how long they live, though obviously that is cool. It's the fact that their risk of death is flat with time. So they literally don't have a mortality rate doubling time. And what's very interesting about them as well is that they essentially get older without getting old. So they don't get frail as they get older. They don't get less reproductively active. They don't have an increased risk of disease. They've got all of these things sort of stay constant throughout their lives. And, you know, maybe in some ways, tortoises aren't the greatest ambassadors for healthy aging. They're wrinkled, they're slow moving, they're toothless throughout their lives. But a 150-year-old Galapagos tortoise is probably pretty much as sprightly as he or she was age 50. And that means they've got something going on inside their biology that allows them to escape this aging process that, you know, curses all mammals. In fact, having said curses all mammals, there are even some mammals actually that have this property. It's called negligible senescence, sometimes known as biological immortality. So that's not true immortality. Tortoises, you know, all these animals do obviously die, but they just have a risk of death that's flat. And the example that we know of in mammals are these little animals called naked mole rats. These are beautiful creatures. I sometimes describe them as like a penis with teeth.
Right.
They're wrinkly. They aren't going to win any beauty contests, to be quite honest. They're the same size as a rat or a mouse. And I already mentioned mice live maybe 2 or 3 years in the lab. But a naked mole rat can live into its fourth decade. And we also know that these animals are very, very well protected from cancer, from cognitive decline, from frailty. And again, they even stay reproductively active right until the end. And this suggests that all of the systems in their body basically stay working until they fall off a cliff at the end of their lives. And so it seems like aging is not a biological inevitability. This is something that, you know, obviously it happens to humans, it happens to a lot of our pets, our farm animals, things we encounter in everyday life. But it's not an inevitable process of falling apart of disease and decay. There are animals in lots of different places, and I suspect there are actually more because we just haven't done the sort of long, you know, hard studies it takes to find these animals that don't age at all. So the question is, can we learn something from their biology and apply that to human beings?
And if you take that tortoise that lives 150 years, why do they die?
Well, they die from very similar. So actually the tortoise who live, we think lived the longest, the Galapagos tortoise Harriet, who was collected from the Galapagos Islands, we think, by Charles Darwin and then managed to survive him by over a century. She lived to 177. She died of a heart attack. And so the fact is, it's very similar to being a human. You know, if you're 30 or 40, your risk of having a heart attack or getting cancer is much lower than someone in their 70s, but it's not zero. You can still get hit by a bus. Obviously, that's a bit less of a risk for a tortoise, but there are external causes of death that can happen to you as well. In the wild, that might be predation, that might be disease. It's actually, you know, cold exposure can be a big deal as well. If you're a tiny little animal like a mouse, it's a cold winter's night, you can just freeze to death. So there are loads of different ways that these animals can die. It's just that their risk of death doesn't change with time.
So that's very helpful. We're going to talk about the diagnosis. You've established the 10-year-old being the safest, you know, generation in history. Can we just talk a little bit about global life expectancy? And I'm intrigued in the variations or the dispersions, as we would you know, say when we're analysing investment performance.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating because the dispersion has expanded and then actually in recent years contracted quite a lot. I think there's this real perception that there's a very poor, you know, developing world out there. They've got less access to sanitation and healthcare and various stuff. And therefore they live, you know, impoverished lives, not only in terms of money, but also in terms of life expectancy. But that is decreasingly true. So if we rewind back to the beginning of the 19th century, most people in most countries could expect to live 30 to 40 years. And it's worth unpacking quickly what that means. I think when you hear that number, you kind of imagine that most people made it into their 30s and then we all died of various stuff. But actually what that masks is two things. Firstly, it masks the terrible toll of infant and child mortality. So actually back in those times, and in fact, even if you were to rewind back 10,000 or 100,000 years into the past when humans were first emerging, you know, as a separate species, then that was basically the same picture. You had about a 50-50 chance of making it out of your teens because you're very likely to die of an infection or something as a very, you know, young child and you're vulnerable and your immune system hasn't fully developed. But if you were fortunate enough to make it out the other side, you know, get into your 20s, you might live another maybe 50 years. So, you know, you'd see 50, 60, 70-year-olds, probably not so many 90 and 100-year-olds as we have today, but people who are relatively old by modern standards would still have been kicking around in, you know, 25,000 BC or in the UK in the 1800s or whatever. What happened after that was we really got a lot of that sort of early life mortality under control. So starting sometime, depending on the country, in the rich world, in the sort of 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, you see life expectancy suddenly starts to climb. And it climbs in this sort of almost suspiciously linear fashion. If you were trying to predict how this would look, I mean, you know, you'd think it might go one way or the other. Maybe we're going to sort of top out and run out of benefits. Maybe it's going to climb exponentially as the technology feeds back on itself. Actually, it just seems to go tick-tock, linear, about 3 months every year since the middle of the 19th century. And it carries on increasing and increasing and increasing. And you can look at this measure called best practice life expectancy, which is where we take the country in the world that has the highest life expectancy in any given year. That has been going up by 3 months a year since records began, in a sense. And that's truly remarkable because the constellation of changes that has underpinned that sort of revolution has been very, very different at different times in history. So in the 1850s, we didn't have vaccines, we didn't have antibiotics, we had one vaccine, we had smallpox, but you know, that wasn't a huge driver. It was mainly sanitation and things like that. As, you know, cities were filthy, filthy places in the early 19th century. We started adding sewers. We started, you know, things just started getting a bit cleaner. And as people got wealthier and education started to kick in and that helps, then we did get vaccines with a bit more of a vengeance toward the end of the 19th, early 20th centuries. We got antibiotics in the middle of the 20th century. And that really did a number on infant and child mortality. And in fact, sort of young adult mortality as well. And that has a really big effect on life expectancy. Because if you die when you're 5, then that's going to drag the average down an awfully long way. So that was a, you know, sort of huge revolution. Prior to 1950, that's where most of the gains came from. But post 1950, we've seen a lot of gains in older life expectancy. So we haven't actually in rich countries got much more to wring out in terms of keeping kids and babies alive better. Because as I said, there's only 0.5% chance of dying in your first year. In fact, less than that in most rich countries in the world today. So we're having to get better and better at keeping people healthy so they don't get sick in their old age. And if they do get sick, curing them, or at least, you know, preventing them from dying, keeping them healthy that little bit longer. And it's kind of remarkable how recent some of these technologies are. When I say technologies, one of the things that surprised me most when researching the book, I was trying to go through the example of coronary care and CPR. So, you know, the cardiopulmonary resuscitation, getting down, you know, chest compressions, mouth to mouth resuscitation, that sort of thing. You sort of think that's such a simple idea that must have been around forever. It was developed in the 1950s and only really went into widespread use in the 1960s, which is just so recent in human terms. In fact, I was watching a drama, sort of a rather silly German drama to practice my German a while ago with my wife, set in the 1930s in this sort of fictional parallel universe. And in one of the episodes, a key plot point is that someone gets CPR and is brought back to life. And that's just completely anachronistic. That would not have happened because nobody knew that was a thing, even as recently as the 30s, which is crazy to me. So, you know, we've now got coronary care units, we've got blood pressure medication, we've got statins, we've got all these different kinds of things, which only came about in the relatively recent past. And what that's meant is that people over the age of 50 are now living longer and longer and healthier lives. So we go back to, say, the 1920s in the UK, life expectancy was about 65. Now my parents are over 65 and they can expect to have, you know, maybe another 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ahead of them. So it's really remarkable how much these things have changed. And, you know, in recent times, it has been by extending the lives of older people too.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm excited to announce that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, known as LSEG. At the heart of the global economy, LSEG provides data, analytics, and infrastructure that connects investors, businesses, and economies. LSEG is where ideas meet capital, enabling sustainable growth and opportunity. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more. Schroders Capital is the private markets division of Schroders, combining the experience of specialized local teams with the scale, rigor, and resources of a global institutional platform. Schroders Capital provides its clients with global access to differentiated and specialized strategies encompassing all private markets asset classes, from private equity to real estate, infrastructure, and the broad universe of private debt and credit alternatives. This approach enables Schroders Capital to access opportunities and investments that are often difficult to find elsewhere, while also having the broad capabilities and perspectives needed to build holistic solutions and deliver tailored outcomes across private markets for both institutional and wealth clients. Discover more at schroderscapital.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. So let's move to treatments. Everybody of a certain age listening to the Money Maze podcast is now leaning in with their failing hearing to this question, which is, how realistic is it to talk about developing medicines to counter aging?
I think it's not just realistic. We basically know it's possible. And the reason I say that is we have got an astonishing number of shots on goal, in the sense that we've got dozens of ways to slow down aging in the lab, and we just need to try some of these things in humans. And there's a sense in which it would be remarkable if they didn't work in people. So to take an example, there's a drug called rapamycin, and that works in yeast. So that's the single-celled fungus that you use for bread and beer manufacture. It works in tiny little millimeter-long worms that are commonly used in lab experiments. It works in flies. It works in mice. It was recently demonstrated to work in marmosets, which are little tiny primates, sort of monkey-like creatures that, they only live about 7 years, so you can do this experiment a bit more quickly. So we've seen it works across the tree of life. And maybe it won't work quite as well in humans because we're longer-lived creatures already and blah, blah, blah. But it would be incredible if it worked across this enormous, basically across the whole tree of evolution and suddenly stopped short. It doesn't actually work in people. So we have a number of drugs like this, a number of other treatments, which we've demonstrated work in mice in the lab. Some of them won't translate. Mice are not tiny humans. It's a sort of classic thing that anyone in biotech will tell you. But it would be incredible to me if none of these things translated. And that's because the mechanisms of aging are really fundamental and they're really shared across the evolutionary tree. So one of the things that scientists have been doing over the last sort of 10, 20 years is categorizing the types of changes that happen in our bodies. And we've now got this list. They're called the hallmarks of the aging process. Depending on who you ask, there are slightly different numbers. I think originally there were 9. Now there are 12. There are 10 in my book, just because of how I chose to break it down for the narrative reasons. But, there's a broad consensus around them being the same kind of thing, depending on the scientists that you ask. And what these are the fundamental cellular, molecular, biological underpinnings of why we grow old. So they're what happen inside our cells, they're what happen to our cells, they're what happen between our cells in whole organs in the body. And this collection of changes, we know that firstly, they increase with age. So that's a sign that they're related to aging, but it doesn't necessarily show that they're causal. But they also have to have this property that if you increase the speed at which they occur artificially, then that accelerates the aging process in various ways. And if you can slow down the rate at which they accumulate, then you can slow down the aging process in that way. So if it ticks all three of those boxes, it's a candidate for a hallmark of aging. And to make that a little bit less abstract, because that could sound quite high-end and scientific, I think the easiest one to explain is what's number 5 on my list, which is the accumulation of what are called senescent cells. Now, we've already come across this word senescent. That's just the technical term for aging. So negligible senescence was the property of animals that have a risk of death that doesn't change with time. These senescent cells, they're basically old cells. Like the biologists were, please don't write in. We can go into some depth about their sort of more nuanced properties. But they build up in all of our bodies as we get older. And they build up for two different reasons. Firstly, these are cells that might have divided too many times. So obviously, as you get older, your cells have divided more times because simply you've been alive for longer. You can accumulate damage to your DNA. So the instruction manual at the center of those cells can get errors, sort of typos in that instruction manual. And if there are too many of these typos, your body will slam on the brakes and turn this into a senescent cell. And we think that evolved as a cancer protection mechanism, because cancer is just a disease where a single cell gains the ability to proliferate indefinitely. And so if a cell looks like it's going down that path, then the body will say, hang on a second, we don't want this, and stop it dividing. Now, the problem is that those cells, once they've stopped dividing, they don't just sit there, you know, chilling out, not causing any problems. The first issue is, of course, because they're not dividing, they're not doing the thing they're supposed to do. So your body sort of slowly loses regenerative capacity, for example. The other problem is that they want to be cleared up. You know, we don't want these cells hanging around in our bodies. So they emit this cocktail of molecules, which are designed to call the immune system over and say, hey, I'm over here, you know, come and eat me, basically, and then clear me out of the system. The problem is that as we get older, these cells are accumulating faster and faster. Our immune systems are also aging. That's one of the other hallmarks of aging. So it's getting less effective at collecting these cells up. And so they gradually increase in number. And it turns out that this cocktail of molecules they're emitting also accelerates the aging process. So it can accelerate cancer, it can accelerate heart disease. It can actually even cause this feedback loop where it causes other cells to become senescent. So it's this real sort of runaway process that can happen to us. And again, that might sound like quite a depressing thing to have found out. Apart from, we now have medicines, they're called senolytic drugs, that can take out these senescent cells while leaving the rest of the cells of the body intact. And scientists did an experiment, I think it was published in 2018, where they got a couple of different medicines. There's something called dasatinib, which is a chemotherapy drug, but they used it at much lower doses than you'd normally use it for cancer. And they combined it with a molecule called quercetin, which is often found in sort of coloured fruit and vegetables, things like, you know, red cabbage and that sort of stuff, sometimes given as a supplement. And they found that by combining these two things together, it was very effective at killing the senescent cells. And they gave this cocktail to mice. They found that it essentially made the mice biologically younger. So it firstly made them live a bit longer, which is a good start if you, you know, claim you're slowing down the aging process. But it didn't drag out that period of frailty at the end of life. It kept them healthier for longer too. So they got less heart disease, they got less cancer, they got fewer cataracts, which are the cloudy things in your lens of your eye that can be one of the leading causes of sight loss as people get older. They were less frail. So they basically send the mice to the gym in these experiments. They've got little treadmills. They've got little rotating rods that the mice have to dangle off. And the mice that had these drugs, they were the same age as the other mice in the experiment, but they were running further and faster on the treadmill. They were able to dangle longer on these spinning little rods, little sort of crystal maze style challenges for the mice. They're just better at them. It seems to also have an impact on cognitive decline. So if you put a young mouse in a maze, it's very keen to run around, find the cheese, you know, do whatever it is mice do in mazes. But if you get an older mouse, it's often a bit more anxious, a bit less willing to explore. And by giving them these senolytic drugs, they cleared out those senescent cells and they seem to rejuvenate some of that youthful curiosity. And honestly, these animals, they just look great. Like I was a computational biologist back when I was working, you know, in real science. And I've never worked with a mouse in the lab. You know, I wouldn't know which end of it to pick up, to be perfectly honest. But you do not need to be an expert mouse biologist. When you see a picture of these things side by side, one of them's got, you know, thin fur, it's got graying fur, it's got little patches of missing fur or whatever. The other mouse just looks like a younger animal. It looks like it should be on the cover of Vogue, whereas the other mouse looks like it's, you know, aging quite poorly. So what this shows us is that these hallmarks, for example, the accumulation of these senescent cells, they're fundamental drivers behind perhaps even all of the aging process, certainly, you know, a significant number of parts of it. And by targeting those early stages of the aging process before they become a problem, we could not treat cancer, but prevent cancer, or at least defer it until later in life. We can defer dementia, but we can also defer the frailty, the cognitive decline that wouldn't quite meet the threshold if you were being diagnosed for dementia, the incontinence, the impotence, all of these things that come along that might not necessarily have a treatment, you know, sort of a way to deal with them in the medical system as it stands at the moment. You know, the wrinkles and the gray hair, people are going to start taking these things for their heart disease, and they might notice they start looking fantastic because it has these sort of other side effects, these positive side effects, which is not often something, you know, we're necessarily expecting out of medicines. So they really do have the potential to change the way that we do medicine. And even more exciting, there are now 20 or 30 companies trying to turn this from something that works in mice in the lab to something that actually works in humans. So this is something that's being invested in now. This isn't something that's 50 years in the future. And honestly, there are, you know, I've obviously given quite a long monologue there about that particular type of therapy. But we have, you know, I could give a similar monologue about maybe 10 or 20 other things that we think are promising aspects, promising sort of interventions in the aging process that work in mice. We just need to try some of these things in humans and, you know, who knows what the results might be.
So one thing I'm clear on, Andrew, is had you been my biology teacher, I would have carried on studying it.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Now, let's talk about side effects. And by that, I really want us to laser in on the, you know, the economics for the want of a, you know, for want of a sort of a simple high level term. We talk about in our market, the total addressable market, but let's just have a little sort of discussion about longevity economics and how we should think about it and putting some numbers on it.
Yeah.
I think you write in the book, or I've certainly heard you say, that slowing the aging process by a year could be worth over $35 trillion. And for those who want a quick reference, that's over 1 year's US GDP.
Yeah, Yeah, these numbers really are remarkable. So let's sort of dive into that first, actually. This is a number that's often quoted. It's from a paper by Andrew Scott, the economist, and a couple of co-authors. And it's a study looking at the value of a statistical life. So this is a thing that's often used in policymaking around the world. And you're trying to decide, should we do a particular bit of road safety stuff or should we approve a particular medication? At the end of the day, these decisions are economic. People often don't like to hear that. But the fact is, we've got limited resources. You know, what is economics if not the study of how we allocate limited resources? So these kinds of decisions have to be made. And so what they did was they looked at the value of a statistical life in various countries. And the one they chose to highlight was the US. And they said, you know, there are also these sort of these benefits that come along with slowing down the aging process. Because if you were to just extend people's life in ill health, then obviously that's expensive. Those people, not only are they costing the system money in the sense of needing healthcare, needing social care, and you know, perhaps needing to be supported at home, some of which could be by, you know, official channels in the sense that you have a paid care, you might move into a nursing home, but a lot of which is done by a sort of casual care economy where people give up work or go part-time in order to look after an elderly relative, which also has costs that come along with it. In fact, I think in the UK, that sort of casual care economy is estimated to be about as big as the NHS's government funding. So it's a really remarkable scale. It's like over 100 billion pounds. They calculated that if you sort of look at this, if you have healthier people, they then stay economically engaged. They're going to, you know, their consumption stays high. They're not costing the system anything or as much in terms of care. And so the scenario they looked at was if we were to slow down aging by a single year, what would that sort of be worth in this broad sense, in this value of a statistical life, in this willingness to pay framework? So this isn't a sense in which US GDP is, you know, suddenly going to become twice as big. This is looked at, discounted in the long term. What is this worth in the broadest possible sense to the economy? And the number they came up with was $38 trillion. And that's just remarkable. You know, you don't hear figures like that every day. There are not many interventions that we can talk about in the sort of global economic and policy sphere where those kinds of numbers are appearing. And there's a sense in which that's a lowball estimate because that's slowing down aging by a year, keeping people alive for an extra year and obviously healthy for that extra year as well. They worked out it basically went up linearly. So if they looked at a 10-year extension of healthy life, a 10-year slowing of the aging process, I think that was $367 trillion, which is just, you know, that's a large amount of money. And again, I'm not saying that that's the amount, that's not the total addressable market. That's not the right way to think about this. This is a willingness to pay calculation. But what it shows is it gives us an idea of the scale of the money that's sloshing around here. Like if you are able to access even a fraction of that, and if a drug costs maybe a couple of billion dollars to develop, which is the sort of figure people throw around these days, there is still an enormous potential to make large amounts of money, to improve huge numbers of people's lives, to sort of spread the positive externalities of this development throughout society to an enormous extent.
So, Andrew, when we just dig into those numbers, I think these are US numbers and they, you know, they may be out of date. Cancer's, you know, costing nearly $280 billion. Heart disease, $200 billion, stroke, $110 billion. I mean, these are non-trivial numbers. Now,
yes.
How should we think about those?
I think so. The first thing to say is those are numbers that I've been using in my talk for a while. They are a few years out of date, but I do think nonetheless, you know, if you add up cancer, heart disease, stroke, and dementia, which are the four that my sort of favorite, that's the wrong word, but age-related diseases, that doesn't even capture the whole of the aging process. There are many other age-related problems. There are the wider, as you know, as I said, things like the frailty, the cognitive decline that isn't necessarily bad enough to be dementia. These slow people down, they make them less economically active. They mean people, you know, suddenly need looking after rather than being able to provide services in the economy. So even if we're looking in this very narrow way, those four diseases cost the economy getting on for $1 trillion. It's probably over $1 trillion now per year. If you think about the US healthcare system, that's $4 or $5 trillion a year. A huge fraction of that is chronic diseases of aging. And that's because, you know, something like dementia, actually, you don't very often die of dementia. It's not necessarily in the top causes of death. That's normally your cancers and your heart disease sort of statistics. But it's very, very expensive because people live with dementia for an awfully long time, often until cancer or heart disease takes their life. And they need very intensive care. We haven't got very great treatments at the moment. So there's not a great deal we can do. And that means these figures, again, they're just enormous. Whatever way you cut this, the economic cost of aging today or the potential of slowing down aging in future, there are obviously different ways of looking at the same kind of thing. And I think the way to think about this is to contrast it with the amount of effort we're putting in to try and do something about it. And to take the US as an example, the US has an NIA, a National Institute on Aging. And this is a government body, a federal government body, that is looking to try and, you know, do research, basic research and applied research into the aging process. Now, there are two problems that arise here. The first is that there's this running joke in aging biology. The NIA actually stands for National Institute on Alzheimer's Disease because for various historical reasons, that's where dementia research is housed within the US system. it gets about $3.5 billion a year, this department. But about 2 of those billions go straight to dementia. Now, that's a very important disease. I'm not saying we should cut dementia research, but still, this isn't the aging biology that I've been talking about today. If you look at what's called the division of aging biology within that, it gets about $350 million a year. That's a little bit north of a dollar per American. And that's remarkable, given the trillions that are on the table here. And the fact that aging causes 85% of American deaths, because if you add up the cancer, the heart disease, the stroke, the increased risk of dying from an infectious disease as you get older, if you do all that stuff, you get about 85% in the US. Actually, the US is a bit of a laggard in terms of high-income countries. Over here in Europe, I think pretty much every country is over 90% of deaths are caused by aging. And the reason that I chose the US as an example is I'm not aware of a European country or the UK that has a National Institute for Aging equivalent. So to take the UK here, we're sat in as an example. We have research councils, we have a biology research council, we have a physics research council. They're sort of split up by subject area. There's not this sort of mission orientated feel in the way that research is funded over here. And so I actually, I've written to the government and asked them how much aging research funding do you give out? They just honestly don't know, which is a political problem in itself, because this is such a big deal. We also need to be thinking about getting private capital in. So there's a slight myth that it's okay, the Silicon Valley billionaires are all funding aging science. And there are some high profile examples of that. They make a great media story. If Jeff Bezos is sinking money into this company called Altos Labs, who are doing fascinating technology called epigenetic reprogramming, which we can go into. But that company, it's worth between $3 and $5 billion, depending on the source that you read. Now, Bezos, I haven't looked at what his net worth was this week, depending on what particular gyrations are happening in the stock market, but he's worth north of $100 billion. And we know he isn't the sole investor in that company. So, but even if he was, let's say he invested $3 billion and he's worth $150 billion, that's a couple of percent of his net worth. And so he's not obsessed with longevity by any means. Like, maybe he considers that a savvy, diversified part of his overall investment portfolio. And then, the number of other billionaires who are really investing in this stuff, probably under 10 globally. And if you think about, there are 3,000 billionaires in the world, I think, again, depending on exactly what the stock market's doing on any given day, they're really not investing in longevity science. So there is an influx of private capital. I think that's, the sort of longevity biotech is increasing, but it's still only a few percent of overall biotech investment.
Well, you have a great grasp of the financial sort of, equation, which not all scientists would have. But if you're sitting there and you're running a pension company or you're sitting there and you're running an insurance company, what would be your one sentence of advice to each of those CEOs?
I think factor this in. I think that's something that really hasn't been very widely done, because what I'm talking about could all be moonshine. Science is like that. Science is, you have to do these experiments. We have to try them out. I think it's very likely that some of this stuff is going to happen, but I cannot put my hand on my heart and say that even if we invest $100 billion in science, that I'm definitely going to get X years of life expectancy out the other side. The challenge is we live at a time now where life expectancy could be dramatically increased. We've got all these ideas that work in the lab. And so if you're a pension fund, maybe you should be thinking, is there a 1% chance that all my clients are suddenly going to live to 120? 1% isn't very likely, but if it's that possibility and you're sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars in assets that you're trying to manage, you're trying to work out how this pension fund's going to carry on into the indefinite future, you need to be thinking about even these outside possibilities. And one of the reasons this is less unlikely than it sounds, because the oldest person in the world ever recorded lived to 122. And in fact, no one else has exceeded 120. So you might be thinking, 120, that's pie in the sky, Andrew, this is science fiction. Let's think about the sort of timeline of the development of these drugs. So we've already talked about senolytics. I think there are maybe 5 or 10 other categories of drug, rapamycin I mentioned earlier as well, which are drugs that we've shown work in the lab. They often have a precedent in human treatments because at the end of the day, scientists, they're publicly funded. They often can't afford the most cutting edge stuff. So they've tried a bunch of drugs that we've had often sort of in the back of the closet. They're out of patent. They've been around for decades. We've tried them in mice. We've demonstrated they slow down the aging process. These are safe enough and well understood enough that we could try, we could start a human trial today if someone, handed me $100 million, which again, tiny amount of money considering the potential benefit there. And say we did 10 of these trials, I would be absolutely astounded if we didn't get at least a year of extra healthy human life. So we've got these ideas that could work in humans. And 5 years is the sort of time scale we need for these trials. So if you're alive today and you've got 5 years of life expectancy ahead of you, you could be around in time for the first generation of longevity drugs. Now, these aren't going to get you to 120. I can put my hand on my heart and say that, I'm pretty sure. But if you're, let's say the average person on Earth today is under 40, that means you've maybe got 40, 50 years of life expectancy ahead of you if nothing much changes. What then happens is you're around in 5 years, of course, for the first generation of longevity drugs. That means you live a little bit longer. Scientists might have 50 years in the future now to develop whatever the next round of treatments is. And maybe in 10, 20 years' time, we've got ideas for things like gene therapies for longevity. Now, these aren't things that I'm expecting to be around next year, but we've had some amazing stories in the news just this week of gene therapies being given to children with very, very serious, life-threatening, lifelong conditions. And as we cut our teeth, trying out these things in really serious conditions where people are at the end of the day prepared to take a risk on, you know, experimental new treatments, we're going to understand the safety, we're going to understand how to make them effective, we're going to understand how to make them cheaper. In fact, you can deliver gene therapies using the same technology that was behind the mRNA COVID vaccines, and they cost a couple of dollars per shot to produce. So the production costs on these things are very, very small. And if we can do gene therapies for longevity, which are a potential thing, you know, we've discovered a gene in an Amish population in the US that makes people live 10 years longer. Again, there are lots of caveats with this. Maybe you have to be living an Amish lifestyle, maybe this doesn't generalize, but we have loads of genes in animals that provide, you know, comparably exciting changes in lifespan. Would I bet against there being a longevity gene therapy in the next 10 or 20 years? I probably wouldn't, because the technology is advancing so fast. It might not happen, but if you've benefited from that first round of longevity drugs in 5 years, you're almost certainly going to be around in time for the 10 or 20 year timeline on the gene therapies and the stem cell therapies and the more advanced stuff. And then AI is going to start crunching lots and lots of data and understanding the aging process in new ways and develop the next round of treatments and so on. And so we do not need aging to be cured next week in order for people to make it to 120. You can sort of slowly push your funeral back into the future. And it might be that someone who's aged 40 today has a decent shot of making it to 100 or a decent shot of making it to 110. And if I was a pension company, I'd be trying to model this in a slightly more serious way than I've just sketched out there and say, you know, what will happen to our balance sheet if there's a small probability that some of this stuff actually comes to pass?
I think the lady in France who you may have referred to, who lived to 120, was allegedly interviewed by a not surprisingly younger reporter. And he said, well, I hope we're around to do it next year. And she looked at him and said, well, you look quite healthy to me.
She was told to quit smoking by her doctor and then outlived her doctor in spite of continuing to smoke until she's in 110. So she had some good genes.
Okay, fantastic. We have a section of these interviews which we call the Outsiders Inquiry, where we get interesting questions. And in fact, the team around the Money Is podcast have been very keen, having Rachel Burke, to ask you some questions. So I'm actually going to get out of my chair, and each in turn is going to come and ask you a question or two.
Okay.
And we're going to see how that works, because it might endanger my permanence in this chair after this interview. So we're going to start off with Maddie Campion.
All right.
Okay. I would love to know, is intermittent fasting worth the hype?
Mm-hmm.
And can you clarify the differences between men and women?
Gosh, nice, small, simple question to start with. So intermittent fasting, I think the evidence is still a little bit out there. I think that to the extent that it causes you to eat less, it can be a useful way both to lose weight and potentially to live longer. But the challenge is, the evidence is frustratingly piecemeal. So we've actually known the first ever longevity intervention that we knew could make mice and rats live longer was discovered in the 1930s. It's what's called dietary restriction. So this is where you cut back what animals eat all the time. Rather than, you know, fasting a certain number of days of the week, they just eat less every single day. And it was discovered by a scientist called Clive Mackay working in the US that rats fed about 40% less, live about 40% longer. And again, as a sort of recurring theme with these aging biology interventions, they stay healthier for that extra lifespan as well. So that's super exciting. And scientists have since discovered that works in loads of different species. So again, you know, the worms, the flies, the mice, the classic experiments that are done. But also things like water fleas. And there's even been an experiment in dogs that suggests that this works. There was actually a couple of experiments done in monkeys that showed that maybe calorie restriction can work in there. And the outcomes were slightly complicated. So it maybe suggests that it gets less effective as you approach humans in sort of lifespan and complexity. But there is really an interesting signal there that it might keep you healthier for longer. The question then is, is fasting, you know, an easier way to do this? Because I don't know if you've ever dieted. I've tried dieting once or twice in my life, and it is hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. I find that when I do, I've tried fasting, and I just always feel so faint in the morning, and I'm like, I need to eat. Mm-hmm. But I think other people really benefit from it.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of that. It's, it becomes a bit of a personal decision. It's like whatever works for you. If this is a way that you can eat a healthy quantity and a healthy diet, and that's part of that constellation, it can be useful. But the challenge is, we haven't got great evidence for humans. So there has been a study called CALORIE, and I can't remember exactly what that stands for. It's a tortured acronym where scientists have like worked their way backwards from what they wanted it to be. They tried to get people to eat 25% less for 2 years. And what they found was, firstly, people didn't manage that. Even though these were being heavily supervised, really helped by scientists, they only managed to cut their calories back by about 12%. They did notice that these people got healthier in a variety of ways. Their blood test results improved in the sort of direction of good health. But it was only a 2-year study, so we don't know if they were going to live longer. And this stuff also comes with side effects. So, for example, it's thought that eating less can reduce your immune function, for example. It can get, a couple of the people dropped out of the studies because of anemia. So they had too little iron in their blood. It wasn't carrying enough oxygen. Their bones might thin. These are all side effects you'd rather not have. And it might be that, you know, maybe it makes mice live longer in a perfectly controlled environment in the lab. But we're a human, we're, you know, where humans are out here in the messy real world, we're coughing and sneezing on each other, we're getting infections, sometimes we fall over. And, you know, if our bones are thinner, they're going to break. And that can often be a start of a downward spiral as an older person. I just don't think we have amazing evidence. As long as you're eating a good balanced diet, you're not getting too many of those burgers and fries and soft drinks and whatever, that's going to get you 90% of the way there. And that calorie restriction, that intermittent fasting, if that's what works for you, if that's what allows you to maintain a healthy weight, if that's what allows you to stay healthy in other ways, that's useful. But I don't think everyone should think, you know, this is some magic key to living to 120. And actually what we need to do is more science to develop pills like rapamycin that can simulate the effects of fasting and have some of those beneficial biological changes, but without being hangry all the time.
I would love to know, what 3 things can someone in their 20s do to help them live longer?
So I think starting healthy habits early is a really useful thing to do. I think it, you know, the obvious stuff is don't ever take up smoking. That's it's kind of so obvious. It often isn't said, but if you do smoke and you're in your 20s or your 30s, actually quitting can more or less eradicate the fact you ever smoked from your biology. Your body will return to that normal. So if you're 30 and you're smoking, you're thinking, you know, it's too late, I've already started. You can actually gain most of the 10 years that you would otherwise have knocked off your life and healthy life back by quitting early. In fact, even if you're 60, if you quit that year, I think you add about another 3 years to your lifespan, even by quitting at that very late stage. So it's never too late to stop a bad habit like smoking. But then eating well, exercising, and I think you know quite a lot of the sort of expected things to do. I think the single biggest impact you can have, though, and this is quite a strange counterintuitive piece of health advice, is actually to campaign for more funding for longevity science, because you're young enough, I'm assuming you are in your 20s, that you're going to be around in time to benefit from some of these treatments, most likely. In terms of something slightly less conventional, because I think a lot of what I could tell you, you probably basically already know, although we can drill into the details of exercise or diet or any specific things if you want. Brushing your teeth is actually very important. And this is something I wish I'd been a bit more attentive to in my 20s, sort of dental hygiene, not drinking too many sugary drinks. I used to drink a lot of orange juice and I wish I'd paid a bit more attention to that. The reason being, back in the 90s, we did these studies where it looked as though people with worse oral health, so more tooth decay, more gum disease, that sort of thing, went on to have more heart attacks and more other problems later in life. And the problem at that stage was, this looks like a classic case in science where correlation doesn't equal causation. So it might be that if you've got poor oral health, it's because maybe you're poor financially speaking as well. Maybe you've got less time to exercise. You're not eating such healthy food. You've got this constellation of bad health behaviors. And as a result, that means that you're living shorter, you're living less healthy, not because of your unbrushed teeth, but because of the other sort of health behaviors that come along with that. However, we now know there is a link, and that link is inflammation. So this is actually one of the hallmarks of aging, is this sort of deregulation of the immune system as we get older. As we get older, our immune systems get paranoid. They start, seeing threats that aren't there. They sort of start running around, shaking their fist at clouds, basically. And that biological process causes, accelerates aging throughout the body. And chronic inflammation, this sort of low-level paranoia, even when you haven't got an infection, even when you haven't got something that needs dealing with by the immune system immediately, is one of the drivers of the aging process. Now, if you imagine having tooth decay or having gum disease, these infections in your mouth, basically, they're caused by bacteria in your mouth. One of the reasons dentistry is so archaic, they literally drill bits out of your teeth. It's almost medieval the way that they deal with our mouths at the moment, is because your immune system can't get on top of those infections. Those are sort of chronic infections in your mouth. And so your immune system is constantly fighting. It's a background of chronic inflammation. And we now know that's the connection. The molecules these immune cells are secreting can increase the aging of your heart. They can increase aging throughout the body. And we've even found some of the bacteria responsible for gum disease in the brains of people who have dementia. Now, we don't know which way that causality runs just yet. We're still trying to understand it. It could be that the bacteria are sort of taking advantage of the diseased brain and sort of using that as a chance to break and enter. Or it could be that some of those bacteria are making it from your mouth through the bloodstream going up into the brain are one of the things that drive that dementia process. And that's evidence enough for me to pay more attention to what I think is sometimes a bit of a neglected part of our health and make sure I brush my teeth, go to the dental hygienist regularly and so on.
Okay, so when researching the book, What were the sort of top three fun facts which surprised you about longevity?
Oh, top three fun facts. I think there are just some amazing stories in this science. I think one of the most amazing is the story of the discovery of rapamycin. So this is a drug that I've mentioned a couple of times before. It extends lifespan in loads of different animals in the lab. And this is a drug that was discovered on Easter Island. So that's the island of the massive stone heads. And the reason it's called rapamycin actually is because the name of that island in the Polynesian, the local language, is Rapa Nui. So it was named after the island it was discovered on. This story is just bonkers from start to finish. It started in 1965 when the Chilean government who owned Easter Island decided they were going to build an international airport. And this island had been isolated it's one of the most isolated islands in the world. It's thousands of miles into the Pacific Ocean. And so the Canadians were looking at this and thinking, this is fascinating. This has been this isolated community for thousands of years. Can we go and collect some samples, find out what it's like before Western civilization and tourists come and pollute it thanks to having this international airport? So they sent down a naval expedition to collect samples of the people of the island, of the environment, and so on. And during this time, there was actually a revolution on the island. The people of the island weren't very happy about this international airport being built and so on. And there ended up being, it was bloodless, thankfully, but there was a lot of sort of fighting and protesting going on. And the guy who eventually became the mayor of the island at one point hid out in the scientists' camp and escaped dressed as a woman in order to avoid being caught. Incredible story. But one of the soil samples they picked up during this trip had some bacteria in it, which later were analyzed, and it was discovered the bacteria had antifungal properties. And a scientist in Canada worked this out and thought it could be an amazing fungal treatment. And so he gave it to one of his neighbors, actually, who had athlete's foot, got rid of the athlete's foot. But they later discovered that it didn't just slow down fungal cells from growing. It also slowed down many, many other kinds of cells, including human cells. And so he thought, this is going to be potentially an incredible cancer treatment. If we can slow down the growth of cells, it's going to be a really big deal. But for various reasons, he just couldn't make it work. And it ended up that the pharma company he was working for shuttered that program. But thankfully, he was very persistent. He took home some of these bacteria, put them in the freezer, put them in an ice cream tub, wrote "do not eat" in massive letters, sellotaped it all together, sellotaped the freezer together. And then when his lab was relocated from Canada to the US, he essentially smuggled drugs across the Canadian-US border as part of his removal process, eventually managed to convince his bosses to reinstate this program. And they did so. And it turned out rapamycin is now an approved cancer therapy. It's also an approved immune suppressing therapy for people who've had a transplant. It's also, if you have a stent inserted, so this is one of the things they put in your arteries after you've had a heart attack and try and expand that artery back up again, they're often coated in rapamycin as well to try and keep the artery open for longer. And then it was discovered in 2009, this paper came out that showed that it slows down aging in mice. So if that's the final outcome of this incredible sort of laborious, ridiculous story, it gets us to that point, and that could be the first anti-aging drug that's ever approved in humans. I thought that was just absolutely incredible.
Okay, I've got another question. Could we ever have a test which works out approximately when you're going to die, and therefore that could shift retirement ages to be dynamic? So they say you're going to die at 90, you can retire at 80. You're going to die at, so it's that kind of, a new sort of policy experiment based off this approximate hypothetical test.
So I think on a sort of broad population level, that's actually a really good idea. And Italy, for a while, has implemented a retirement age that's pegged to healthy life expectancy. I think it's pegged to overall life expectancy, but the ideal for me will be pegged to healthy life expectancy. And I think that would, firstly, governments obviously target GDP. That's a very well-known figure. They very rarely target life expectancy. And if GDP goes down, the Bank of England gets involved, everyone in the economy is trying to work out things to do about it. There are policy levers that can be pulled. If life expectancy goes down, we don't really have a directed policy response. And I think it'd be fantastic if governments had a legal mandate to have that as a target as part of their sort of broader economic and health and wellness of the population indicators. I think that'd be a fantastic thing. In terms of for individuals, I think I can see some ethical issues with the way that might be applied, but we actually already do have such tests. So there was a test that was developed in 2012, 2013 called an epigenetic clock. And so your genetics are your DNA, the sort of instruction manual inside your cells. And if you imagine that analogy, the epigenetics are then the sort of notes in the margin, the little post-it notes, the sticky things, the underlines you've made, telling the body which genes, which part of your DNA to use in which cell at which time. So that's a dynamic thing that changes depending on the conditions, depending on which cell it is in the body, depending on the time of your life. And we found that initially in 2012, 2013, when they were first developing these things, they trained them against chronological age. So you could get someone's epigenetic data and you could predict how old they were to within 4 years. Now that's interesting, but we do already have a technology for that. It's called birth certificates, and it's much, much less laborious and much more accurate than plus or minus 4 years. But the question is, those people who've got an older epigenetic age than their birthday, you know, candles on their birthday cake age, so to speak, are they at increased risk of death? Are they increased risk of disease? The answer turns out to be yes. So you can have an accelerated epigenetic age, which means you're older than your birthday cake candles, or you can have a decelerated epigenetic age, which is younger. Now, these things were first trained on chronological age, which isn't really the right thing, but there have since been other clocks that have been trained on time to ill health or even time to death. There's a clock called Grim Age, which is rather appropriately named, that was trained on how long it was until people in this massive collection of patient data died. And so you can use these things and you can predict people's dates of death reasonably accurately, you know, to within a few years with these clocks. So whether or not we should use it for pension age, I think is an open ethical question. Whether we should be thinking about using these things in screening in hospitals, for example, because, you know, it often becomes the case, you go past a certain age, you start getting colonoscopies or you start getting mammograms if you're a woman. And so maybe we should be tying these things not to your chronological age, but to your biological age, because we know, and I think this is quite intuitive, actually, all of us know someone who's just turned 60, who's vibrant, who's still hiking, who's still working, who's still loving life, and someone else who's just turned 60 and they're haggard, they're wrinkled, they're, you know, maybe suffering from a couple of chronic diseases. It is very clear that we age at different rates. And so I think, you know, that's a very intuitive demonstration of the fact that biological age is a thing. And so if we can come up with ways to quantify that, and I think we are, you know, getting slowly better at that in the lab, maybe we should be using that to better deploy healthcare resources as well.
My question is, if you could go back to your early, mid, late 20s and change one thing about your life, knowing what you know now, in order to increase your health or your longevity, what would it be?
That's an interesting question. I think I've already mentioned I wish I'd taken better care of my teeth.
Yeah.
I do wish I'd got a bit more into exercise earlier, and particularly strength training. That's something I've just turned 40, and so I've really started like trying to be a bit more serious about going to the gym and lifting weights. That doesn't have to be how you do strength training, by the way. You can climb. There's all sorts of things you can do, but just not cardio. Because I think that I've always found cardio very accessible. You know, I can just go out for a run. I can jump on my bike. I can, sort of almost not quite, but no equipment required. Whereas the gym, I've always found a bit intimidating. I know there are certain people who grow up in the gym and they're pumping iron from, you know, back at school or university days. Because I think we've really come to realize that strength training is super important in the long term. And it's all about building those early habits, because I think when you're still in your 20s, you don't have too much to worry about. And thankfully, you know, you stay strong almost regardless of what you do. But as you start to move into your 30s and certainly your 40s, you're starting to lose something like 10% of your muscle mass every single decade. And that isn't going to really affect you in your day-to-day life unless you're lifting heavy things all the time until you're hitting your 60s, 70s and 80s. But you want to start from that higher base and you want to make sure you've got more of that muscle mass earlier in life.
Yeah, I've heard with strength training and also resistance training, it's also really impactful for women as they age, because we lose a lot of bone density, especially if you've been dieting your entire life. And that really helps with that.
And the other thing is that I think after menopause, as soon as your ovaries start producing fewer hormones, one of the big impacts is that your bones start to get thinner. And we are understanding more, I think, about the importance of replacing those hormones as you get older. And that science is very much developing. And I'm very excited to see that, because I think historically women have been quite neglected in medical research. But I think one of the really good things you can do, we know that when you do resistance training, when you lift heavy weights, your body senses those heavy weights are being lifted. And the two things it does is it, you know, builds muscle in order to try and make you more effective at that. But it also feels that pressure in the bones. And that does seem to sort of beef up that bone density a bit as well. So particularly for women, that's super important. But also it's never too late. And one of the things that really struck me, a study that I found while researching the book, they got people in their 90s and they started them on a strength training program. And this probably isn't, you know, what you and me are imagining pumping iron in the gym. But through this strength training program, over the period of a couple of months, they got stronger. They were able to lift more weights. They were able to walk further and faster as a result of this muscle building. It's kind of interesting, because although muscle loss is driven by aging, there's certainly a component of it which is driven by lack of activity.
Yeah, of course.
And it's kind of a psychological thing, because as we get older, we perceive ourselves as less able to exercise. And obviously that's true. You know, don't go bonkers if you're in your 60s and suddenly start running out and, you know, pumping massive, running marathons and pumping iron if that's not something you're used to. But I think a lot of that decline is reversible. So if you can start doing it, it's never too late, but it's also never too early.
Great.
So, Andrew, we've just upped the average age at the microphone here. I've returned and I have just a couple of closing questions, which, of course, is you. What is your most important daily habit?
I think my most important daily habit is actually building family and social connections. I've got a one-year-old baby at home, and the evidence around this really shows us that people who maintain that social connection, maintain that sense of community until later and later in life, do tend to do better. They tend to live longer. They tend to live healthier. But not only that, you know, I'm not seeing this baby thing as a purely reductionist way to expand my life expectancy. I just think it's so important because, you know, what do we care about? I think it's very easy. You know, we talk about lifespan, we talk about life expectancy. That's how long people live. There's a word that's really growing in popularity, health span, which is not just how long you live, but how healthy you live, how long you stay free from chronic disease, how long you stay able to do, you know, the activities of daily living is the jargon, but you know, how long you're able to do your hobbies, to travel, to do the things you care about. But I think the things that I really care about are the humans, you know, the people in my life. It's my parents, it's my friends, it's my family. And I think that's what makes life enjoyable. And there's a bit of a movement, actually. You know, we've done lifespan, we've done health span. Maybe we should start talking about joy span and thinking how long we can stay happy for.
And finally, there was an article in the Times, November 28th, on these two sisters who have been working on something called Linkgevity.
Yes.
I think it's Karina Lern and Serena Kern-Librera, and they're up at Cambridge University, and they're partly funded by Sir Michael Hintze of, you know, CQS. You have been thinking about a think tank. Mm-hmm. Just tell me a little bit about what are the next steps for Dr. Andrew Steele.
I've been thinking, I think the most important thing, my book came out in early 2021. I've been talking about this stuff to anybody who'll listen for the years that followed that. And I've really come to realize that the most important questions in this field, I'm fascinated by the science, I'm a scientist originally, but actually they're policy questions, they're finance questions, they're questions of getting policymakers and investors and members of the public interested in real longevity science. I think people, you know, some people read my book and they come away and they go, oh, wow, you know, that's really cool, Andrew. I'm going to start, you know, going to the gym or brushing my teeth more. Those are important and worthwhile things. And I don't want to denigrate public health at all. I think it's very, very, you know, it's critical and people can live longer and healthier lives as a result. But then I sometimes say to them, did you read the previous like 8 chapters about medicines that literally slow down the aging process and might mean we have to worry slightly less about the lifestyle stuff, hopefully, in the long run? And I think that particularly this word longevity, it's really come to mean a million different things to a million different people in the modern age. If you're scrolling down your social media feeds, you see, you know, people who used to be fitness influencers now talking about themselves as longevity influencers. And there's a sense in which that's true. You know, I think exercise does literally slow down the aging process, looked at in the round, and it's an incredibly effective form of medicine. But I want there to be incredibly effective forms of actual medicine. And I think that getting that message through to people is just so, so important. And the people I want to speak to about that are their politicians, their policymakers, they're people who've got their hands on the lever of research funding. They're also people who've got their hands on the levers of regulation, because at the moment it's quite hard to get a drug approved for aging. If you've got a drug that treats a specific disease, then, you know, that's more straightforward. You can often do the trial a bit more quickly because you can find a bunch of people with that disease and show that it improves their prognosis. Whereas if you need to do, you know, the first proposed trials on aging are probably going to be 3 to 5 years. They're probably going to be 3,000 patients. These are big phase 3 trials. And so maybe we need to have innovation prizes. Maybe we need to have accelerated approval pathways. Maybe we need to be thinking about integrating these trials into healthcare systems as they exist at the moment. There are loads of big policy questions. The economic questions are vast.
So I'm not quite sure how to even start my conclusion, but I think that it is a subject that you are deeply involved in, and it deeply, absorbs all of our, you know, not all of our time, but a lot of our time, particularly as we get older. And you are pointing to some very significant steps that have been and are being made. These, these drugs around senescence and, you know, repairing, you know, cell damage, the importance of, you know, thinking about anti-obesity. And I know in another talk you talked about, you know, why some of those compounds, the semaglutide for one, being, you know, very, you know, beneficial. That your point about dental health and inflammation is lost on a lot of people. And when we think about practically from an investment and keeping your finances in order, I would remind everybody that savings are deferred consumption. Mm-hmm. And we live in societies where debt, where consumption is 65 to 70% of GDP. And then I'm talking about those US and UK. And so, you know, think twice before you spend randomly, advice I often give to my children. Eating less, there is definitely propensity to gain in the West to eat more than, you know, is required. The reason that we own equities is that they're long duration assets, and as you think about your savings, the essential requirement to save, one needs to think about the components, and you know, the bond component may serve a purpose in a long-term asset portfolio, but it isn't what generates those inflation, you know, beating returns. And family and friendship is more important than fasting.
I would say so, yeah. And in terms of the investing, I think there's a fascinating case to be made here that investing in longevity science and longevity science companies, startups, biotech, it's a hedge. Because imagine this stuff works and you do suddenly find yourself staring down the barrel of 10 extra years of retirement. If those companies are the reason that that's happened, then you're going to have some money in order to, you know, fund that, those extra years of retirement. If the companies don't work, you're not going to live any longer and, you know, things come out in the wash. So I really feel like there's a case, perhaps on an individual level, but certainly for things like pension companies, if they can make some bets on these things, I think it'd be a fascinating financial hedge as well, because, you know, the success of this is really the success of all of us in the long term.
So get your portfolio diversified. Andrew, it's been fantastic. Thank you for coming over for Germany. Maybe not exclusively for us, but we really welcome you here today, and good luck with your great work.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for having me.